Welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and I'm speaking with Dan Brunberg, who's a professor in the Department of Government at Georgetown University and also serves as a special advisor for the United States Institute for Peace's Muslim World Initiative, where he focuses on democratization and political reform in the Middle East and wider Islamic world. He has authored and edited numerous books and articles, including Conflict, Identity and Reform in the Muslim World and Reinventing Khomeini, the Struggle for Reform in Iran. And already there's evidence that within the elite that some of them are a little unhinged, but now it looks as like the regime itself may be coming unglued. WikiLeaks is reporting that the head of the Revolutionary Guard Corps slapped Ahmadinejad in the face because he wanted more liberalization of the press in order to put down the demonstrations. And the head of the IRGC, Muhammad Ali Jafari, slapped him in the face and said, you're wrong. You created this mess. So what are we to make from that?
Well, I mean, there has been disputes within the regime. Even when after Ahmadinejad was elected for the first time in 2005. So in some respects, this is not a new story. These tensions within the regime became worse, widened, and escalated after the repression of the Green Movement in June 2009, having excluded most of the urban kind of middle class from politics. The regime has left to sort of fight among themselves. And I think Jafari, the head of the Revolutionary Guard, in fact, had a point when he chastised the president for being essentially a hypocrite, because now suddenly Ahmadinejad, worried about his own popularity, is criticizing the repression of the opposition, whereas, as Jafari himself correctly pointed out, it was the Iranian president who presided over that very process of repression and helped to instigate it, along with the Revolutionary Guards, in June and July of 2009. So there's more hypocrisy to go around for everyone. And this is ultimately a story of jockeying for power among different elements of the regime. All are wed to one another by a marriage of convenience, and all of whom pretend to sort of get along, but all of whom are constantly looking behind their backs, distrustful of the other one.
Well, you recall, Dan Brunberg, there was a period during the Reagan administration when we were looking for Iranian moderates, when Oliver North and company went over there with a cake, etc. And it feels like we're back visiting that idea, whether there's any moderation within the top reaches. It doesn't seem that way with the IRGC, the Guards Corps, and the Basija militias. I mean, arguably, they fit the definition that has essentially been, I think, discredited by our neocons, that they're Islamo-fascists.
Well, I have great concerns with those sorts of terms, but I would certainly say that this is a very hard line of power-hungry political elites who believe that day has come and have reached the top of the greasy pole and now are trying to exclude each other. But it is also the case that in the process of doing that, they have undermined the more pragmatic, mainstream conservative political elite who helped to create the revolution, and particularly the drive to control the economy through what looks like or what purports to be a process of privatization, but really is a way of Ahmadinejad and his allies to line their own pockets, have alienated important members of the clerical political elite as well as the mainstream conservative elite. Whether we wish to call them moderate or not, the fact of the matter is that they aren't happy with many of the actions of their president, and whether they do or do not provide an opportunity for negotiations or might, under certain conditions, support negotiations with the U.S. is an interesting question. But terms such as moderate and extreme are very difficult to sort of fathom in this context of this vicious power struggle.
Well, I suppose what is clear about the legacy of the neocons is that their misadventure in Iraq has truly strengthened this regime in Iran. The fact that Sadr, the cleric, just returned to Iraq from Iran as an important player, and the more that you learn about what's going on in Iraq today, the more it looks like Iran is the winner of the Iraq war.
Well, that is true, and not only have the Iranian regime benefited from the situation in Iraq to extend its influence in Iraq, and of course has extended its influence considerably in Lebanon, But the Iranian elite in and around Ahmadinejad has been very adept at extending a whole series of relationships with a whole diverse network of countries, including Brazil and Turkey and Venezuela, to some extent Russia and China. They see themselves as succeeding in helping to create a kind of alternative pole to Western political power and to promoting a process of competition in the global arena, which is constraining U.S. power. And I think that whether or not this is true or not, and this is a matter of considerable debate, certainly the leaders, including the Iranian president, tell themselves this story. They believe that they have a success story, and that really has tended to increase their sense of power and that they can hold on, and that whatever their own internal divergences and tensions, they are united in their determination to thwart U.S. power and, of course, to undermine and isolate the political opposition. So it would be dangerous to assume that evidence of internal struggle within the regime is in any sense an indication that this regime is about to splinter or to become unglued or to fall apart, to fragment, or to not exercise considerable influence in the region. The Iranian regime looks to us often isolated, and we tell ourselves that success story, but from the perception of those in power in the regime itself, they are riding a wave.
Again, I'm speaking with Georgetown Professor Dan Brunberg, who's also a special advisor for the United States Institutes of Peace's Muslim World Initiative. We're talking about whether or not the regime in Iran is becoming unglued. The foreign minister was fired in a way that suggested that, at least to me. What's your reading on that?
Well, I've twice been to meetings with the Iranian president during which Mottaki was president, in New York, and said not a word. It was always clear to me from that small anecdotal experience, but from reports elsewhere, that Mottaki was a kind of dress foreign minister. He tried to exercise influence and hasn't done so in a long time. Now that doesn't mean that the president of Iran is calling the shots. I think ultimately it's the supreme leader, Khamenei, who calls the shots. But certainly there was tension between Mottaki, the foreign minister, and the Iranian president, who believed that he couldn't trust Mottaki, and that Mottaki represented the more mainstream conservative elite. And I think that in many ways is true. And now he's been pushed out of office, and it gives, at least for the moment, another possible victory to the Iranian president.
I understand, though, Dan Brunberg, that now that they've had to raise prices on gasoline, which is heavily subsidized, and other commodities, basic commodities, that the people are getting even more fed up with this regime. But, of course, we know from what happened to the Green Movement that they simply don't have the power and that the state has tremendous tools of repression. So where do we stand on the notion that the Bazaaris and may get together with the Green Movement and force their hand of this regime? Or you're suggesting earlier that we're kidding ourselves if we think they're falling apart.
Yeah, I don't think. I mean, there has been an escalation of various kinds of social protests within the urban middle class and lower middle classes beyond now, and has accelerated since June 2009. Teachers and drivers and bus drivers and workers of different kinds, and these have escalated. But none of this, there's no evidence that there is a kind of cross-class coalition led by a political leader who can pull these disparate groups together, and not only pull them together, but as you quite correctly pointed out, attract support from the urban conservative mercantile class, the commercial class, in ways that would really affect the coherence of the regime. There was last year there were protests from the bazaar against proposed tax increases. The regime reduced greatly the percentage that they threatened to increase, and in so doing, it could be said that they mollified the bazaar and provided less impetus for the Bazaaris to align themselves with the professional middle class and the workers and the urban poor, those groups that have been protesting. So you have a disparate feel. Different social groups are unhappy, and the reduction of subsidies has exacerbated this problem. And there are many members of the middle class who depended on these gas subsidies. If you would drive around Tehran for a day or even half a day, you would notice that there are these private independent taxis, which are essentially individuals who drive around their cars and offer rides to other people at low cost. And that whole business thrived on subsidies, and that has basically been shut down now. There's been a severe drop in consumption of gas. How long that will last, we don't know. But we also know that Ahmadinejad and his allies are probably pretty adept at channeling a lot of the savings from this reduction of subsidies to their own bank accounts. So what looks to us from the outside, again, is an example of the regime sort of forced to take measures which undermine its credibility, which is to some extent true. At the same time, is a dynamic that the regime is trying to use to enrich its own pockets. And again, it's not necessarily going to provide the basis of instability or fragmentation on the one hand from above, or the unity from below that some would otherwise imagine.
So, Dan Brunberg, given this recent spate of what to many of us seems ludicrous and comical and absurd, starting with Iran's reaction to the WikiLeaks, where through the Hezbollah papers and others, they've tried to put out the line that Julian Assange is a Mossad agent and the WikiLeaks cables are an invention of the Mossad, which, you know, only I imagine, I mean, there are gullible people over here who believe that kind of stuff. But I wonder if how many people inside Iran believe the idea that this vulture that they captured with a transmitter saying made in Israel on it. I mean, God, if the Mossad's going to send a vulture, at least they'd take the made in Israel sign off the transmitter. But I mean, and then now this American woman captured with a bug implanted in her tooth. As silly as it seems, there is a real side. There are a couple of hikers, American hikers, are being held purely for ransom. They have no intelligence connections. At least that would seem to be the case. But these other ones are absurd. So, does this play well? I thought that there was a fairly educated, you know, group of Iranians, a substantial middle class. I mean,
There is. You're absolutely right. It's this middle class, this amorphous middle class, which grew up under the umbrella of an expanded education system in the 80s and 90s, which has been, in essence, revolting against the regime, and the regime is trying to suppress it. And I would say that the members of the Green Movement and the opposition who are affiliated with this broad social class, and it's not in any sense a homogeneous class, most of them would laugh at the regime's claims and attach no credibility to them whatsoever. But then you have to look at the political and social roots of the rising political elite around Ahmadinejad, one that has very little exposure to Western education, many of whose roots are in the countryside, and who thrive on these sorts of on conspiracy theories that you and I would think are patently absurd, but are believed to be true by many of the people, including the president himself. So it does play well among a certain constituency, and spewing this sort of these crazy conspiracy theories also helps to sort of recharge the sort of ideological batteries of the regime. So it looks from the outside to be a totally absurd gambit, and from the inside, it is for some absurd and others perfectly true. And that's the reality of an Iranian society which is deeply divided.
So Dan Brunberg, if this regime is to last, and if the Green Movement has been effectively suppressed, that's not to say that there are lots of seething people who can't stand it, both in the diaspora and within the country itself, and they don't like the isolation and the embarrassment that this regime is bringing them. But on the other hand, when we were talking earlier about how Muqtada Sadr, the anti-U.S. cleric, just returned to Iraq from Iran, where he's been in exile, and the extent to which the Iranians seem to have enormous influence over this Iraqi government that we've put into power, I get the impression that that Iran may end up having tremendous influence over Iraq, and once Iraq gets on its feet and starts pumping oil, I'm wondering whether that's going to make Iran stronger, not to mention Iraq.
Well, of course, once Iraq starts to pump oil, there'll be more supply.
That's true.
That, of course, is not something that necessarily the Iranians would wish to happen. But I think your larger point is correct, and that is that they're going to have a very close friend in Baghdad. They already do. But I would also caution people who study Iraq and Iraq Shia communities much more closely than I tend to argue that too close an embrace between Iran and Iraq could backfire on Iran. The Iraqis are still Arabs. They have their own nationalist agenda. The coherence of Iraq is still important, certainly to the Arabs, both Sunni and Shia. They have profound differences, but an effort of Iran to sort of turn Iraq simply into a kind of colony of Iran could easily provoke a kind of backlash and could undermine Maliki's legitimacy. So I think what the Iraqis want and what the government want is all the benefits of a close relationship with Iran and not the liabilities. And it's not always going to be easy to keep that balance.
But do you think people inside Iran, they must have learned from WikiLeaks that the Saudi leaders and the Arab leaders in the neighborhood are urging the Americans and the Israelis to get rid of the regime in Iran?
Well, that links up to your former point about conspiracy theories. I think that for the Iranian regime, there's a serious perception that this is a manipulation of the U.S. government meant to demonstrate a kind of broad coalition of among the Arab, particularly the Gulf states, against Iran. And they probably do feel that it's a kind of contrivance, which, of course, is ridiculous. We know that the Arab leaders in the Gulf try to mollify Iran with relatively moderate language, but behind closed doors, they have expressed great consternation about Iranian power. The Iranians would like to believe otherwise, but it's certainly the case that the Gulf states feel very concerned about Iran's increasing leverage in the region.
Well, I thank you for joining us today in Los Angeles, Dan Brumberg.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye. I've been speaking with Dan Brumberg, who is a professor in the Department of Government at Georgetown University and the author of Reinventing Khomeini, The Struggle for Reform in Iran. He also serves as a special advisor for the United States Institute for Peace's Muslim World Initiative, where he focuses on democratization and political reform in the Middle East and the wider Islamic world. Let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the state of California.